Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host a conversation with an individual whose inner journey inspires us and whose work is transforming our world in large and small ways. Awaken Calls are an all-volunteer-run offering of ServiceSpace, a global platform founded on the simple principle that by changing ourselves, we change the world to create a more compassionate and service-oriented society. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. My name is Bela, and I'm really excited to be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. Today, our special guest speaker is Denise Bonnaig. In a few minutes, our moderator, Gina Shaw, will begin by engaging in an initial dialogue with our speaker, Denise. Thank you, Gina. I'll hand it over to you now to get the ball rolling.
Thanks so much, Bela, and I'm also really excited to have the opportunity to moderate this conversation with Denise. Denise Bonnaig is by profession a trial lawyer in immigration, civil rights, and workplace litigation for over 30 years. She's also a life coach and founder of Authentic Coaching and a yoga teacher and owner at Princeton Power Yoga. She's a Vipassana meditator, she's a mother, and her life experiences have taken her across the world and into herself. Let's start off with a little bit more exploration with Denise about her life journey. Denise, could you explain something about how your early loss of your mother, your father's encouragement, and then the academic achievement and professional accomplishments as a lawyer, your later struggles and transformation, how that has developed into the person that you are?
Certainly. Thank you, Gina. Thanks, Bela. And thanks, everybody. I'm very excited to be with you this morning. Yes, Gina, to come to your question, I was born in Cameroon, back in Central Africa. And I will never forget the day. Actually, it was the night that my cousin, who was living in Cameroon with us, burst into the room where the girls were sleeping, shrieking, "Sister died, sister died." We were taken to my mother's friends and my cousins and siblings. Altogether, I was probably 6 years old. And I remember when I woke up in the morning, I escaped from that place, from my mom's friend's home, and ran home to take a peek at what was happening. I was stunned, lost, puzzled. Out of the blue, there was my mother. I didn't know what to do. I'm not sure I understood what death was. But somehow I became a rebellious child, so to speak. Very rebellious. And mostly I was arguing with adults, speaking my mind. And it is during that time period that I began to ask myself the question of who am I? What is going on? And because of that, I got in trouble a lot. Yes, some of it, maybe I was responsible for starting fights. But also, at that time, I made the decision not to allow people to make me wrong, but instead make the people wrong. And that was the birth of my control freak attitude. So eventually, My younger sister and I, she was just 2 years old, we moved to another city with my aunt. And it, you know, life was just so miserable. I was not happy. And I decided to go back to my dad. So that way come the encouragement part of the question, my dad. So my dad was all about education. I noticed that he was always praising people who were doing well in school. You know, he talked about hard work a lot. And I made a decision then to work hard, to study hard in school so that my father would love me, because I felt nobody actually liked me. I was so miserable as a child. So I was making my dad happy because I was working in school. So I started feeling some love. And what is great about my dad, he inspired me so much. Because he admired his own mother. He talked a lot about her. She was very strong-willed. He said she instilled in him those values that he instilled in us, because I had two other sisters. I'm talking about strength, independence, education, and in fact, I call him a feminist because one of his favorite sayings was a woman first diploma, a woman first husband is her diploma. That is, she focused on education rather than thinking about getting married. I'm 64 years old. At the time when I was growing up in Africa, I was about more a woman being married than being educated. So my dad was not about that. And you know, he planted the seed of success. You know, that striving attitude, that hard work in me. So when I graduated from high school in Cameroon, I moved to France to attend law school. That way I met my husband. We moved to the United States with my younger son. He was a toddler then. I did not know English, nothing. I didn't speak English. And of course, I was lost again. What can I do? Eventually, I had a second child and studied English using the New York Times a lot and a notebook. And I ended up, attended New York University Law School, where I earned a Master of Comparative Jurisprudence while raising my children, because my husband was a resident in medical school. And then the journey began. That is when what I call my boxing years began. It was just like I was wearing boxing gloves in and out of the gym. That's how I was before embarking into this journey of self-discovering, self-inquiry. It was just about boxing through life. I was going to box my way through my career, through raising my two kids, then would do everything to be successful. That's what my dad told me. You really have to study hard, work hard. So the mantra that I had at the time, I didn't really think I was miserable. So my mantra was, I was going to box my way through life, not my.
Gina and Denise, are you there?
I am here. I don't know if we could hear Denise.
Okay.
I'm not sure if the call just dropped.
Yeah, I'm sure she'll dial back in. Thank you to all of the callers who have joined to listen to Denise's story. And we're just waiting for our guest to reconnect.
Hello?
Denise, we can hear you now. Sorry, it seemed like the call dropped.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. I'm so sorry.
I'm glad you rejoined us. We can hear you. You rejoined us, and you were telling us about the boxing glove years and how you were boxing your way through these challenging times when you were working through your career and raising your children. And I think that's right where we left off.
Okay, I'm so sorry about that. So, yes, I was boxing my way through life. My mantra at the time was, you know, just keep punching. You know, punch harder. You go good. So I was a walking resistance machine. Absolutely. I didn't know anything about mindfulness at all. I didn't know anything about meditation. I did not know that I could see lightness throughout the day. I didn't know that imperturbability was a possibility for me. All I knew was that there was no way where I could be totally happy, just enjoy life, because life was just a struggle nonstop. Then something beautiful happened to me, and that's the beauty of yoga. Then I discovered yoga, and everything changed effortlessly. I remember, you know, studying with Baron Baptiste, and everything was calmer. And in the process, after I certified, I became a certified yoga teacher. I began to teach yoga, and eventually I ended up going back to school and becoming a certified coach, and created my own coaching model that we can talk about. So that really made a difference in my life, the discovering of yoga. It was really all over the place. Then I became more of a mindful person. And did I answer the question, Gina?
You absolutely did. And what a amazing story. And it sounds, I think, from what we covered earlier, it sounds like the yoga came before another major life challenge. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your diagnosis of cancer that came about after you discovered yoga, and a little bit about how you approached that, which is, I think, really interesting and different than our usual cultural narrative where we talk about fighting cancer. You had a different approach. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that part of your life struggle and transformation.
Yes, certainly. So that was, I believe, approximately 11 years ago. Right after a beautiful Thanksgiving with my family, I had everybody together with my sister's family. We were so happy. It was right after that time period that I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And thanks to yoga again. Why thanks to yoga? Because the way I discovered that I had breast cancer was that was during a private yoga session with my friend and yoga teacher, David. So he was teaching me how to be stronger. And What he told me then is that he noticed that my left side was weaker than my right one. And David was trying to help me strengthen that left side. For example, he would teach me how to do push-ups using just the left side. And, you know, I kept doing it. But also, I was really, that was intriguing, and I was very puzzled. Why is it happening? Why is my left side weaker than the right? And as part of my practice at the time, I had learned about, I believe it was Louise Hay's mirror exercise technique. And what I remember is that you place yourself in front of the mirror, totally naked, and you honor each part of your body. So it's a way of learning to appreciate yourself, to love yourself. So when I say appreciate yourself, anything that you see, you're fat, you're thin, and anything else, you like this part, you don't like this part, you like your hair, your face, you want to be there in front of that mirror. You don't run away, you face it, you observe it. So I did that exercise then, and noticed that I had two lemur-sized beans on the bumps on my left breast. Then chemotherapy followed. But I kept working, and I kept teaching yoga all the same. Why? Because of yoga. I decided that I will not identify with the cancer, with it. I decided that, well, I learned from yoga, I'm not my mind, I'm not my body, so I'm just going to let it be. Of course, get the best doctor to do their job and not interfere with that, not allow my mind to go there, not allow my mind to fight cancer, right? Because I learned from the Buddha, what you resist, persist. Just be with it. It was no longer the boxing years where I had to fight my way through anything. No, I just have to be, yeah? To be nothing. It's so much benefit in being nothing. So that was my approach to the cancer diagnosis. I was not going to identify with it, nor become it. No, I was not in denial either. Yeah, granted, I didn't share the cancer with not even my family. I still have family in Cameroon. Even my younger sister, who's so close to me, she was in France then. She didn't know anything. It was just my husband and I and my oldest son, I believe, who was in medical school then. So neither. Identification with the cancer, and also inspired by Marianne Williamson in her work encouraging, I believe that was AIDS patient, writing love letters to the disease. I wrote a love letter to my cancer. I wrote a love letter to it. So the letter, I looked for it, Gina, I couldn't locate it, but in essence, I know what I put in that letter because I do recommend that a lot with students who work with me or people who are going through the situation I went through because I can relate to that. So to the cancer, what I say, we are sharing this body together. I'm not my body, so it's a body that I'm using. This physicality, this physical body for this lifetime, I'm using it. So you came in, we're sharing it. You do your thing, I do mine. I'm not going to bother you, you're not going to bother me. So you be and I am. That way, I didn't have those negative thoughts, all those negative thoughts coming to my mind. I would sit, in fact, before writing that love letter, I sat in meditation. I know I was crying, all the thoughts coming up, thinking of my children. My youngest child, I believe, was in fourth grade then, or what was going to happen. And then everything went pretty well. So the only thing that I didn't say in that letter, after saying, you do your thing, I do my thing, I'm not going to criticize you or judge you. We just be, you be, I be. I didn't say I love you. Maybe I should have. I didn't say I love you. So then eventually, I didn't resist it. And yeah, I learned that what you resist, persist. So it went away.
What a story, and what a different way of addressing a challenge like cancer. And along the way, tell me about how you discovered Vipassana meditation.
Yeah, that's, again, thanks to yoga. You know, yoga, the best thing that ever happened to me after the birth of my oldest child. It's really yoga that led to everything that's happening to me now. So in my journey as a yoga teacher, every year I go to Costa Rica. I go to Costa Rica where I start a 200-hour teacher training or a 300-hour teacher training. And during one of the breaks, I had a massage with, I believe he was an Ayurvedic healer, they call him then. And, you know, we had a wonderful session. We had a discussion also. And after that session, he told me that he bet there's something that I haven't done. I've spent a lot of time working on my personal transformation and helping others. But he knows there's another tool that I can bring into that would be really helpful to me. So he wrote down on a piece of paper, and that piece of paper I still have, he put the name of Vipassana meditation, and I did the research. It took me a year, but I started. So I've been a Vipassana meditator for 8 years now. I go every year around my birthday.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how has your experience of meditation affected the way that you practice law?
Yeah, that's a benefit that was not intended when I started to meditate. The very first thing that I noticed was in my relationship with opposing counsel. In fact, I didn't call them then opposing counsel. I called them my adversaries. That relationship changed overnight. There was, and there still is, more civility on my part. And I didn't see any nastiness on their part that I used to see. We used to fight all the time. Not pleasant words. But now we can disagree. Of course, we're representing opposing interests. We're doing our jobs. We're doing our duty to our clients. But that minus the bitterness. There's no bitterness whatsoever, no hatred. So we're having normal interactions. And that also what I noticed is that it leads to cases being settled out of court or going through a mediation, you know, a non-binding mediation. where we sit across the table and we talk about the issues with more understanding, with more compassion. There's no fight. There's no need to fight. We're all the same. We are one. And again, this is an unintended consequence of that, is that my adversaries, even those people who used to be my adversaries, the other lawyers, even referred cases to me. Wow, that was a big aha moment. And also in my relationship with my husband, he was noticing that I was not after everything. The control freak in me was kind of disappearing, was letting go. There was peace with my children. There's a big gap difference between my two older kids and my youngest one. So there was 10 years difference with the oldest one. I raised him in a totally different manner. He was not subjected to the abuse, so to speak, that his brothers were subjected to. So that, thanks to yoga, just to be, mindfulness, compassion, presence, acceptance, love, beingness. Did I answer a question, Gina?
How beautiful. Absolutely. I think from what you've been describing, you started off by needing to be right, as you called it, becoming a control freak. And you made your way through some difficulties by fighting with your boxing gloves. But then It sounds like you found through yoga and meditation and reflected it in your home life and in your professional life in a completely new way of being with the world, being with others. And it's really nice. And I wanted to ask how now you take some of your insights and you coach people, because you're also a life coach. And so I'm imagining that you can communicate the new possibilities that open up when life is not about fighting and conflict to those that come to you for coaching. So I'd be interested to hear about your approach to coaching and how you might reflect your transformation in the way that you coach others.
Yes, Gina. And again, yoga shows up once again. Because as a yoga teacher years ago, I was running boot camps, 40 days to personal revolution, inspired by Baron Baptiste. And it is after one of those 40 days immersion, where I received lots of thank you letters from the participants, that I remember one of the students wrote to me that she sees me as, yes, her yoga teacher, a spiritual guide, and a life coach. Wow. So I was kind of puzzled, because for me, coaches were just in the field. My son had played sports, so the only coaches that I know were sports coaches.
Right.
And in fact, I myself was a soccer coach for my youngest child. So I was puzzled. And I kept back wondering, what does she mean, being a coach? I became curious about coaching, about those coaches outside of the sport arena. That way I discover that there's a field, the life coaching field. So what I did then, I went back to NYU and obtained a personal and executive coaching certification. But you know, now that I think of it, even before attending that, obtaining the coaching certification, I was already a coach, so to speak, because I remember long ago one of my yoga students telling me that she went through her divorce without a therapist because she was just coming to my classes and listening to me. So she had my voice in her head all the time. Wow. And my approach to coaching is kind of the fusion of spirituality and strategy, so to speak. Spirituality from my yoga side and strategy from being a litigator. And in the process, I created a coaching model that I call FUGT, that is F for forgiveness, U for unconditional love, G for gratitude, and T for trust. So the model in general is about resolving the underlying issue that the coachee has before going through anything else. It might be somebody who wants to write a book or somebody who is looking anything. But we want to start with making sure happy with herself or himself. So we go through that that exercise to see there's a pattern, something that is happening, and it's very informative. And in the process, the person is empowered. It's just about coming up with those powerful questions and having the coachee taking some responsibility. You know, coaching is not therapy. For the coachee to be accountable to do it, it's not something that I do for them. But we work through the process, so that they can come up with that missing ingredient, so to speak. And it really works.
Do you have an example, maybe an application of this that might come to mind in your recent experiences, how you use this model with somebody?
Yes. Yes, in my law practice, I had an individual in his early 30s, late 20s, who felt miserable at work. He felt there was differential treatment going on. And he, in my view, he had a case. So before even addressing the issues in the case, I noticed that he just was so miserable and he had no way out. He had no tools to help him go through the process. He knew nothing about mindfulness. For him, it was just them against me. So in the process, and when I do that for my clients as an attorney, I don't call it coaching. We're just having a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I can discuss openly, you know, I can bring up confidentiality issues. Yeah, but, you know, you can feel like he had this huge burden that began to, where he began to surrender so that he can have more clarity to deal with the issue, to see what happened. And in the process, he learns, yeah, because there's the next job and then the next job, so that there's not a repeat on what happened at this job. And, you know, the testimonials that the clients write really show that it works. We can work together and not fight all the time. And fighting doesn't mean you have to win at all costs. And winning doesn't mean money all the time. Your happiness doesn't come from money, doesn't come from the outside. It's from within. So we take responsibility for what is. You know, you take responsibility because, hey, when you take responsibility, for me, you are in charge. Yeah, meaning I can change it if I'm responsible. I can turn it upside down. I can turn it around. It's more empowering. So that's what I do with my clients too, and they are so open to the process. And that's how referrals come about. Very open to the process because it works. We all into this together. There's so much misery in life. Yeah, the Buddha said there's misery, but we can also get out of our suffering. The beauty of yoga.
How amazing the translation of your experiences and your teachings into your coaching and your law practice. And there's one other aspect I want to ask you about, which is your practice is around workplace civil litigation and immigration and discrimination, right? There you must have clients for whom there has been injustice.
Yes, there's been injustice.
And so I can imagine that there might be a sense of justifiable anger in a way, or they might feel, or you might even feel that they have been wronged, that the process has wronged them. How, in that sort of situation, is it helpful for them to maintain a sense of peace about it and not fighting when it might seem like there's a reason to fight, that you're fighting for right, you're fighting for justice? How do we view that, you know, in your setting, and maybe how does that work even outside of the specifics of a case? I hope that's not too vague of a question.
No, it's not vague at all. And I want to clarify that just because I work with a client to be more mindful doesn't mean we don't vindicate the right. We do what the law allows us to do, but in a different manner without bitterness.
Mm-hmm.
And we it's still there, you know. In fact, I had even during my breast cancer episode, I had women who were being fired from their job because they had breast cancer. Mm. So now that's against the law. So we really work hard with the fact that we have to vindicate their rights. And in this particular situation with this young guy, he was very happy because not only he learned a lot about mindfulness, but he got a very good result in his case. And I do believe that we were able to obtain that result because the client became less resentful himself and more understanding. Does that make sense?
It sounds paradoxical that you win by not fighting in the same way. Is that what you were saying?
That's what I'm saying. What it is that, okay, I'm entitled to this, and I'm going to work through the system to obtain it. But in working through the system to vindicate my rights, I don't have to fight with the people I'm against. Do you understand? We can, you know,
yeah.
The manner in which we talk, we're civil, we argue, but with civility.
Yeah.
And we come up with a better result, in my view, because there's no bitterness. When you go to bed at night, you don't remember the bad word that you told your adversary or another party in the case, you remain kind, trying to do the right thing.
That does sound very effective and more peaceful.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So for all parties involved, that mindfulness, that presence, that that letting go of those attachments and aversions, it kind of helped. We move on. We try to live in the present moment and see what we can do better next time and not dwell in the past, on those things that didn't work out as we think they should have.
And so then, as you're moving through the world without having to fight with the boxing gloves, and you're in your own way encouraging calmness and peace while working through the system to maintain people's rights and ensure justice, I imagine that there still may be times that there's disturbances, that it might be difficult to stay completely calm. We all have ups and downs, and there's still some instances where it might be hard to get through certain experiences. And so now I wonder about how the work that you do in the world then affects your own practices of yoga and meditation, for example. Do you find that things come up that you work through in your internal practices in a particular way through yoga or meditation?
Yes, and that is daily. That's why every year I go to a Vipassana retreat to reset. And after the retreat, I do my very best to continue sitting twice a day, meditation. Normally, an hour sit. But even when I don't have a full hour, I do sit. And that is a daily practice. without that, I wouldn't be able to function. And when I don't meditate, I call that when I don't do my work, there's a lot of suffering. Those thoughts, those negative thoughts that come through my mind, they don't go away. They're there. But I train myself to observe them, to become aware of the thoughts without attaching to them. I train myself to let the thought go. And that is something that I do, as I said, constantly. It's not easy, but I think it's simple. Just take a commitment, and that is something that I agree to commit to, because it has helped me, it continues to help me. I'm happier now that I was in my 20s, my 30s, my 40s, because I came into this pretty late in life. And for me, that is the way, because it works. Whatever the problem is, there is a way. Yeah, I learned from the Buddha again, there's a way out of suffering. And that is the way, you know, in search of that truth, by sitting, doing nothing, just observing my breath as it goes in, as it goes out, the breath and how I feel in the body, on the top of my head, to the tip of my toes. Doesn't matter what sensation come around, I observe them. Yeah, resistance come back. I don't resist them. And in my own practice, what I notice is that when I don't resist, they go away. When I allow my mind to digress and, you know, come up with all type of stories, it persists. It becomes worse. So that's my journey. When I feel lost, when I'm angry, I feel rejection, or whatever it is, I don't resist it. I don't run away from it. I go toward it. Making the decision to let it go. Because, yeah, life is a decision. I said, I decided that's my journey. Hmm. It's just like brushing your teeth. You won't think about walking out of the house without brushing your teeth. So for me, that's how meditation has become.
And I'm wondering how it's affected your family as well.
Yes. Yeah. My youngest child, who lives with me as a meditator, I think benefited a lot from that. He's 25 years old now. And he attended a Vipassana meditation retreat. Actually, he went twice. The first time he went to just sit. And the second time he took his aunt with him and he served. And he is, you know, and he continued to meditate daily. We speak the same language, and he's getting his brother to join us, and his father would join us too. So he's working on that. So, yeah, you know, having a family that meditate together is good. That's my prayer. Maybe someday that would happen. But it's very rewarding. And my youngest son too, he went to a teacher's training with Baron Baptiste. That's where I began. What opened the door for me. So really, it works. And what's good is that he's going to graduate from Georgetown Law School in D.C. And it's good that he has that tool. He really doesn't suffer that much in law school as I suffered when I was in law school.
Yeah. And thank you so much for this extended opportunity to talk with you. I think now I'll turn it over to Bella, and we can ask some callers to join the queue for questions.
Thank you, Gina. And Denise, thank you so much for everything that you've been sharing thus far. I think that a lot of callers also would like to join this conversation. And as a reminder, you can press star 6 to join the queue, and then I can let you come into the conversation. And I think there is someone already in the queue, so let me go to that person.
Hey, can I ask my question?
Yes. Hi.
Okay. Hi, Em. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for the setting up this session. My name is Mo. I have a question. If some close I would like to know how you look at this issue. If some close family members hurt you in different ways by talking or accusing or saying something, whatever, and in a way they hurt you, and then you distance yourself from them so that you reduce your interaction with them. Does this act that you distance yourself from them and minimize their interaction with them, does it have conflict with mindfulness and compassion?
Well, I wouldn't think so, because I am not imposing my way of being or my lifestyle on the other members of the family. I can talk about it and invite them without forcing it. This is not a situation where I want to be right about my technique or what works for me. It is something that you have to come to yourself. So, you know, I can be a meditator, I can focus on mindfulness without forcing the people in my family. But what I observe is that when you change your way of being, the other people notice. Because it takes two to fight. One person cannot fight with herself. I'm not sure I'm answering the question, but it's not imposing, you know, my mindfulness technique on other people. It's just sharing how they work for me and suggesting that if you give it a try, it might work for you too.
No, that was not my question. My question was hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. My question was that if they somehow, you had some type of interaction that they hurt you, and instead they are continuing to do that, they are not mindful and they are not compassionate, and they continue to do that. if you distance yourself from them and say, okay, I'm going to cut the communication, I'm just distance myself, if it's not required, then I'm not going to interact with them. It, from my side, is it what I do, the action I do, is it, does it have conflict with mindfulness and compassion toward them or not?
I wouldn't think so, personally.
Okay.
Not at all. Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to read one or two reflections and questions that have also come in through the web chat. And that's also a reminder, if you're not on the phone call, to press star 6, you can also email us your questions at ask@servicespace.org. So this is a reflection from David Doan. He says, how are you doing, Denise, with your need to always be right? That's a difficult one to let go of. Being in the present, paying attention to process more than content, listening closely to what I am experiencing and to others, opening my eyes and ears to see and hear what is rather than see and hear my thinking, paying attention to detail and growing an awareness of our oneness rather than separateness helps shed the light of awareness on what holds me back and helps set me free. There is no way out of suffering. We each suffer our life and our life experiences. What we can do is learn to suffer efficiently in a way that doesn't create unnecessary pain. I think that is what you, Denise, are doing. Thank you. And then there's a reflection from Christopher Bonet. He asks, who is your favorite son? Just joking. My real question is, what is your vision for the future?
Wow. My vision for the future. What comes to mind is we can work together. There's this quote from Rumi, who said, I, you, he, she, we, in the garden of mystic lovers, those are not true distinctions.
Mm.
So together, we can focus on alleviating suffering and helping others, being of service to others. I feel that we are so blessed and so fortunate. And it's our turn to give back. Then the question always is, how can I serve? Be of service.
Mm. Thank you.
Ask the question. Hopefully.
I actually have a question for you, Denise. I was really intrigued to hear about your experiences as an attorney before yoga and meditation and then after. I'm also a previous attorney myself, and I've been in situations where there's where we're going through interrogations, and it's just it really does feel like you're in a room with the adversary, and there's so much negative energy. And I'm also a Vipassana meditator, and there's been instances where I've tried, when I was practicing, to bring as much equanimity as possible within my own self, to be able to just be in that energy and try to move through it. So, you know, when you were describing bringing, the impact of Vipassana on your perspective of law and seeing them as opposing counsel rather than adversaries. I'm just curious to know how did the opposing counsel, how did you notice a shift in them? Because it's really hard, actually. I mean, having been in that context, because the legal field is so adversarial, how can you give maybe an example or a story that was, very adversarial, but how you're able to bring your practice into the space and how it shifted everyone in that space?
And without giving a specific example, is before my meditation use, let me start that way. Before my meditation use, I would have a case, and right away, I had the gloves on. That's what it was. I was going to fight through it. All I saw is the other person being wrong, and all I saw is my client winning. But contrast that with being mindful. When I deal with a case now, it's just two parties that have two stories, and we are in the search of the truth. But mostly you have the truth, it's in the middle. You have your story, I have mine, and then there's their story.
Mm-hmm.
The difference now is that I'm not getting in the room with an objective of I'm going to fight. Now I'm going in the room with working things out to solve the problem. And yes, time still continues to take litigation where we have to take it all the way to court and have a judge, a jury decide what, who prevails. But in doing that, we don't need to do that with bitterness. We can be objective. We can look at the facts in an objective way without being subjective. We look at the evidence as it is. It's just like, when I sit in meditation, for example, and I think of something that I said, and I say, well, I said that because he said that. I should have said that when he said that. So it's the voice in the head that is speaking. So whose voice is it? Who's the voice that is speaking, and who's the voice that is listening? So I want to eliminate all that and come to what is concrete. And for my purpose, it's the evidence. We deal with the evidence. How do we prove that?
Mm-hmm.
We have the facts, and then we have the interpretation of those facts. So we can interpret those facts without animosity. It's just the hatred. That hatred that keep coming in. I want to control you because I'm not good enough. Feeling that being vulnerable is something really bad. Not being you, pretending. The gloves are off. Let's talk about it. Let's be candid and speak the truth about it. Just as the good one said, the truth shall set you free.
Denise, when you speak like this, I'm actually reminded of Gandhi as a lawyer and, trying to get justice on his side, but without any ill will towards, in that case, the British. And it's quite I just find it quite consonant the way you're talking about your approach and what I know, which not that much, but what I've heard about Gandhi's approach. Really, really inspiring. And
yeah,
I wanted to...
Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, this duality, you know, good, bad, you know, beautiful, ugly, all that, it kind of holds us back. So I'm not saying that I'm able to get rid of, but the awareness of it makes a big difference to me.
Mm.
It is. And then as a Vipassana meditator, we talk about this impermanence of life. It comes and it goes. It comes and it goes. And then we move on. I mean, does it help to have hatred toward the other? What's the benefit? Does it help me to fight in court with other lawyers? Does it help? You know, what is peace? You know?
Mm.
Even at to bed at night with your mind at peace, resting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Not forever, is it?
Mm-hmm.
And Denise, I wanted to, yeah, thank you so much. I wanted to ask you about maybe the first caller's question that you answered, and maybe we can talk about the why a little bit. So as I understood the question, it was a little different context. It wasn't where there was a commitment to engage, right, in a legal case or, you know, in some other situation. Both parties have decided to talk to each other. But what I understood in his situation was that he could make the choice, or maybe he has made the choice, to distance himself from some interaction with someone that was not helpful in some way. And I think he was asking about whether disengaging is itself mindful. And I can imagine that it might depend on a lot of things, right? Like whether you consider something mindful or constructive might depend a lot on various circumstances. But I think it might be interesting to talk a little bit about that, because in certain situations, we don't have to engage. We can walk away. We can walk away with maybe with peace. Maybe we can walk away just saying, I don't want to get hurt. Maybe this is not going to be helpful. Maybe, you know, there could be different things in our mind of why we turn away and not engage. And so how do we approach that? I imagine these kinds of situations may have come up in your life or in your experiences coaching others. What do you tell people who might be considering whether to engage in something that could be unpleasant or whether to just distance themselves?
Yeah, it's quite a decision they choose to make. In my view, it has to be an informed decision, meaning you have to go through a process and ask yourself the hard question. Why exactly? What's the problem? What is your desired outcome? See, once you know exactly the desired outcome, and you know, it will determine whether the disengagement actually is the desired outcome, then yeah, so be it. If that's what brings you peace. I don't think it's a situation where somebody can tell you what to do or not to do. This is something that you have to come up with, and that's the beauty of coaching. So the conversation would go into the detail of the matter, examining the factual situation, the pure facts, without interpretation of those facts. And maybe go a little further and see the facts from the other person's point of view to come to the truth. And in that coaching model of FUGT, if in your disengagement, yeah, you can say you're holding a grudge against that person you're disengaging with, yeah. Can you say you accept that person's position or love that person unconditionally? You know, those are some of the elements that we work with, because if you make a decision on the surface without examining it deeply, it's going to come back. I noticed that in working with people. So you want to really go deep in the problem and ask yourself and face yourself and be truthful to yourself and see the truth. And if you can live with that, with this, yeah, then so power to you.
And to follow up on that, Denise, I was curious to know, experiencing that forgiveness and unconditional love, gratitude and trust, you described how you go deep into the root of an issue that a client might be dealing with, and you guide individuals through this self-inquiry. I wanted to know, do you also introduce meditation, or if not meditation, some sort of experiential practice into your coaching? Because I wonder, you know, you can experience or rationalize forgiveness in your mind by being guided through, you know, very deep reflective questions. And you could come to an understanding of unconditional love through your mind. But then how do they actually embrace it in their heart without an experiential practice?
Yes. So it's a process. Forgiveness is, you know, pretty much straightforward in that you would come up with a list of the people that you have to forgive. And I noticed that lots of people put themselves on that list. And you go through each person to determine what caused you to put them on the forgiveness list and what were the issues. You know, whatever might have happened in the past, walk it through. It's not something that happened overnight. For the unconditional love piece, we actually start with acceptance, because that is something that everyone understands. Accepting the situation as it is, not because we advocate mediocrity, no, because we want to be objective and see it as it is, not as it should be, so that we have clarity and take the steps that are necessary, do what is necessary to take action. So you ask if meditation, I introduce meditation. I don't call it meditation for someone who has never meditated. We start very, very slow and easy. Mm-hmm. We call it moment of silence. And it's an investigation that they do by themselves. I said, well, let's start with 5 minutes. And then we talk about what went on during the 5 minutes. And then we build into it. Does that make sense?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I was rereading or reflecting on the quote you shared earlier from Rumi. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if I remember all of it, but you said, I, you, he, she, we, in the garden of mystic lovers. And I'm curious to know what the ideal field of law and justice would look like for you if you could recreate the way that we approach justice and injustice? Would it be in the way that the system is set up right now? Or if you could do it all over, what would it look like from your experience and perspective?
Wow, that's a question. That's a question, Gina. Because to me, at this stage, love is the answer. It might mean nothing. Because, you know, I've been there. Loss, illness. That's part of the impermanence of life. Even with the system that we have now, it depends how we implement it. It's starting our relationship in our house, you know. My relationship with my spouse, your relationship with your spouse, your significant others, your children, everyone. You know, because wherever you go, here you are. So maybe the key is working on myself. Wherever you go, where you are, I heard that from John Kabat-Zinn. He's actually the person who introduced me to mindfulness. I remember, I believe it was in 2005, I was in Rhinebeck, New York at the retreat with Baron Baptiste. And I noticed so many people in his group with Kabat-Zinn, they were taking their lunch, eating lunch in silence. And I was looking at them, observing, I said, my God, what are they doing? They're so calm. There's so good, positive energy coming from them. So I approached one of them and I said, what are you guys doing? You work a different way. You're so relaxed, so calm. What are you doing? And he said, we are at a meditation retreat with John Kabat-Zinn. And he just wrote a book. I forgot the title of that book. Coming to Your Senses, something to that effect. And, I went to the library, bought the book. And he was signing it. I stood in line. I waited more than an hour. I skipped the yoga practice. I was just there waiting. And it was my turn. You know, John took some time with me because I was saying, look, I've been, sitting and doing nothing. You're wasting time. You got to get going. There's so much to do. Can you sit and do nothing? So he listened to me. And he told me to be present, and he autographed a book. He said, may this be your door in. That's how I started. So to answer your question is that inquiry, that working on the self, on me, and if all of us do that, the world would be different. I think.
Thank you. I would say that I definitely agree with you. I think we have time for one more question before we end with our group question to you. And so I think maybe I'll ask that if, Gina, did you want to jump in or is it okay if I?
Please go ahead.
Okay. So I was smiling when you shared your experience listening, learning about meditation from John Kabat-Zinn, and your immediate reaction was like, why are we wasting time sitting? There's so much to be done. And that made me think about you. I think you shared that you sat about eight or so Vipassana retreats. I would love to hear a little bit more about your first Vipassana retreat of, you know, sitting for 10 days with that very rigid schedule. Was it challenging for you? What were some of your initial key insights from that first meditation retreat that you experienced?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. So I walk into there, you know, you give your phone, your keys, and everything. You get in there, you have all these instructions, what to do or not to do. I was on board with everything, you know, because I have to go in there and do what has to be done. That was 8 years ago. First day, I'm there sitting. I thought I was going to die. My body was aching, falling apart. But then I'm saying, oh, come on. Nobody forced you to come here. Just sit. It was horrible. But I had to finish it. Didn't want to move. Second day, it was worse. And during, you know, after lunchtime, they let you walk out outside there's a backyard where you have to walk their trees. And something really I'm really not proud of. Say, I walk and I had a thought of climbing a tree and falling off the tree so they can take me to the hospital so I can talk, so I can communicate with people, because I felt it was a nightmare. But then I had a thought of a student of mine asking me what they should do in that situation. So I calmed down, I became more present, and the tree was acceptable. Day four, the Vipassana technique started. Day four, it was absolutely awesome. I had a dream with all my relatives. I saw my mother, my grandmother. It was all awesome, and I felt really good. But then ego come up. I said, oh, okay, well, it's not a big deal. I'm mastering it. Then on day five, I fell off again. It was just a nightmare. So it was in and out. Working with a technique, the voice in my head kept chanting and blaming me and criticizing me for doing it, for not knowing what I was looking for, always in search of whatever it is, just be. Yeah, I kept going. It eventually got better, so better that on the last day, I really didn't want to leave. I didn't want to leave, and I committed to going back. And every single year is different and getting better and better. And this past fit, I think for the first time, I came to the realization that, well, ignorance is not knowing that you can train your mind to get out of your own suffering. You can let go of your talents, you can let go of your aversion, but that ignorance, you have to know that no matter what, you can train your mind to let go of what holds you back, to let go of the suffering.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that and everything. We have one final question for you, and that's, how can we as the larger service-based community support your work, Denise?
Wow. How can I support your work? You're doing so beautifully. I'm so grateful and so humbled to be part of this call. As I was sharing with Gina, so very, very humble. what can I do? And I know what I can do. I've been talking about the organization.
Mm-hmm.
No.
I think that you've already given this community so much through your beautiful presence this morning or afternoon or evening, depending on where you are in the world. And the energy in this call is very palpable. And so I imagine there will be many ripples from this conversation. Very grateful to you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Gina, for facilitating such a beautiful conversation. Thank you, Denise, for sharing with so much authenticity and beautiful insight and wisdom about your life journey. And thank you, everyone, who's joined this call for sharing your presence.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.